Blog Talk Radio.
You took my son away from me. You know how hard it was for me to get him to stay in school and graduate. You know how many black men graduate? Not many. Because you bring them down to this type of level where they feel like I don't got nothing to live for anyway.
Usually I might clown, but right now, this one's for Mike Brown, so pipe down. We gotta stop all the rioting in the streets. We ain't doing nothing but proving we animals to police. Another child dies, another mother cries. Another neighborhood left with a whole bunch of wives. Why did they pursue him? Why they have to shoot him? But I don't think that the answer is everybody looting. But forget that cop, he deserves state time. They let Zimmerman off, this cop ain't learned from Trayvon. I'm just sitting here dropping a little tear of knowledge. Cause Mike Brown ain't even lived to see a day of college. He would've started soon, that has an empty seat in class. All because of these demons hiding behind a bag. So screw that badge, screw your protection. And screw that law, carry your weapon. But some of these stores y'all looting is black owned. I know it's for a cause, but some of them still have families at home. It's not a black or white thing, it's about abusing the law. I can't imagine Dorian's face when he saw Mike fall. My tears wet in the page while I'm writing this. I know y'all so in tune, if you not, why you fighting it? Just let go, let your heart beat and never lose control. And God rest his soul, cause I am Mike Brown. I am Mike Brown, he represent us all. We from a similar town, walk them similar streets. We got similar police, so how I know I ain't gonna end up under a similar sheet. So I am Mike Brown, cause I'm out here with my homie. I'm just walking my block, man, everybody know me. So I am Mike Brown, I am Mike Brown, I am Mike Brown, homie, I am Mike Brown, I am Mike Brown.
He shot again, and once my friend felt that shot, he turned around and he put his hands in the air, and he started to get down. But the officer still approached with his weapon drawn, and he fired several more shots.
I am Mike Brown, I am Sean Bell. I am Larry Davis bleeding in my dingy cell. I am Angelo Clark, I am Oscar Grant. I am Dante Price doing what you others can't. I am Bo Morrison, Melvin Lawhorn. I am the voice of these people cause they are long gone. Let's go behind the badge, fall behind the beat. Behind the politics, they wonder why we don't trust police. They wonder why we carry nines on us. They look for drugs but shoot for anything they find on us. I am Justin Sitt fighting for my life kicking. Slowly dying cause police said I look suspicious. We are all of these people in so many ways. I am Raymond Allen, left to die for 2 days. I just bought a new hoodie, guess I'm Trayvon. I am Dwayne Brown, lay down, try not to die. All the halls I feel my heart beating slower, listen. And all you dealing with is maybe gonna lose your pension. You might not notice this, but this a new form of lynching. I got my hands up, but still I see that cop inching. The mystery of this, I think I never know. Why they had to shoot him down, couldn't just let him go. The mystery of this, I think I never know. Why they had to shoot him down, couldn't just let him go. I am Mike Brown, I am Mike Brown. He represent us all, we from a similar town. Walk them similar streets, we got similar police. So how I know I ain't gonna end up under a similar sheet. So I am Mike Brown, cause I'm out here with my homie. I'm just walking my block, man, everybody know me. So I am Mike Brown, I am Mike Brown, I am Mike Brown, homie, I am Mike Brown.
My son away from me. You know how hard it was for me to get him to stay in school and graduate. You know how many black men graduate? Not many. Because you bring them down to this type of level where they feel like I don't got nothing to live for anyway. They're gonna try to take me out anyway.
Good evening and welcome to another Friday night edition of Center Stage. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. Thank you for joining us for what should be another very interesting show. For the past several weeks, we have covered the murder of Michael Brown by Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. We have also covered the Ferguson protest. However, tonight, we will be spotlighting the people behind the movement, the Ferguson protesters. These protesters have gotten the attention of the world. So tonight, we want to find out what is the driving force behind this movement. What has caused these protesters to march in the heat and the rain? We also want to better understand what kept them going when they encountered tear gassing, real and rubber bullets, attack dogs, and a militarized police presence. And that is what we want to know tonight. How did Mike Brown's death start a movement that has brought attention to police brutality around the world? But before we begin, we want to remind you that the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage, the host, or advertisers. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, let me introduce my co-host. Tonight we have Mr. Christopher Vaughn. He's an activist and organizer. And also we have Mr. Mark Daniels. He's an activist and a blogger for Global Political Awakening. Good evening, guys. Welcome to Center Stage.
Good evening, Mark and Carrie. How are you doing?
I'm great.
Good evening. It's good to be with you all tonight.
We can barely hear you, Mark.
I said it's good to be with you again tonight.
Thank you. You know, this should be a very interesting show. We've had we've talked about the murder of Mike Brown. We've talked about the Ferguson protest, but tonight we're spotlighting the protesters, the people behind the movement itself. And so we're so excited. I know one of them has got to get back to work, so we're going to open up the phone line, y'all, and start talking to some of them. I'm not familiar with some of the numbers on the board, so I'm going to open up the phone lines. I know Edward Crawford is on the line, and 314-726. I'm not familiar with your number. Good evening.
This is Zaki Baruti.
That's okay. Good evening. My guest tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is Zaki Baruti. He's an activist and organizer for the Justice for Mike Brown Leadership Coalition. We also have Edward Crawford. He's the Ferguson protester in the iconic photo that you see of the young man with the flag on his shirt, and he's throwing back what appears to be a tear gas. Also tonight we're supposed to have with us Attorney Jerry Crawford. Attorney Jerry Christmas, and he's the attorney for Edward Crawford. And we're also supposed to have Chaz Scott calling in and some of the other protesters that have been on the front line of this movement since day one. So good evening, Mr. Baruti. How are you?
I'm doing well. And how are you, Carrie, and to your co-hosts and everybody that's listening?
Great.
Hello. How are you doing?
We're great. Actually, one caller we're going to have to take because he's on break, and we'll call right back to you, Mr. Baruti. Good evening, Dorian Fields. How are you?
Hello.
Hello. Is this Dorian Fields?
Yeah, it's him. I can't talk that long because I'm actually on a short break. I just want to call in and show support to say hi to everybody, get my blessings. I only got actually like 5 minutes to speak. I thought I only have to probably like one question. Okay.
Well, we're going to talk real fast. Okay, so you have been on the front line since day one, and we really want to understand for those who have been on the front line since day one, what took you out there in the first place, and what has kept your momentum up all of this time? It's almost a month into it now. What has kept up your...
Because me, myself, and the others, like Skeeter and my sister Spook and a lot of other brothers and sisters out there, I just believe we all were team of people that care about our community, care about our people. We didn't come for cameras. We didn't come for attention. We actually had no idea this would ever blow up then. So it originally started off with the people just caring about their community, that caring about their fellow man. And that's the reason why I've been out there, because, I mean, I care since day one, because, I mean, this is like it's like family. Even if I didn't know Michael Brown personally, this continues to happen to black young men. I'm a black young man. I have a big role brother. So I want to do all I can to help fight this battle so they can stop.
Okay. And the young protesters have become known as Lost Voices, correct?
You say what about the Lost Voices?
The young protesters, some of the young protesters that have been out there since day one, they've named you guys the Lost Voices. Is that correct?
No, I don't know. About the, I mean, I've been hearing people shoot all type of things. Like they've been calling us the Ferguson Free Fighters. I heard someone say the Lost Voices, but I think the fact when I got on there at the press conference Saturday at the march and spoke, they said the Lost Voices because I represented all the people that no one listens to, and that was like my biggest issue with the whole thing. It's like a lot of brothers came out there when the cameras came, they came in their suits and their ties. They wanted them to put in the, like they was, as if they were more important than the guys in the streets. But let's be quite honest. When Mike Brown was laying there dead, most of these people didn't even care. They only came when the brothers in the streets raised hell, started looting, started burning their buildings, and all the cameras and lights came behind what the brothers in the streets did. So my whole thing was to get out there and speak for those people, because those are the ones that are actually making this movie move. And, like, they, no one's checking for them. No one's even looking for them. They just looking for the guys with the big names, and it's kind of funny to me because those guys are not out here fighting the battle. We are.
Okay. So you all have been out there and have, you know, actually been on CNN and some of the other networks, and so people believe it and understand it, you know, your passion. We do feel that. And we really want to commend you guys for what you've done, because you all have stood up in a way that a lot of us older ones didn't have the courage to do.
Yeah, because our generation is a lot more fearless than a lot of the elder generation. Like, I was talking to some older guys in my job, and they all like, oh, my God, y'all better go down to the Klan coming. And it's a very big difference between that generation and my generation. To my generation, we talking like, oh yes, the Klan coming. Come on, y'all. Come on, we waiting on y'all. Come on. We've been waiting on y'all.
You don't have that
that's
fear.
That's the difference.
No, there is no fear.
I spoke at the press conference. I broke it down to the elders. I could never the BC generation before crack. And I look at our generation as the AC generation after crack. Like, our generation was the generation when the fathers left our homes and we picked up our women. Our generation were, we've been programmed through propaganda, through music, through media. And we were already, we prepared to die. We've been taught our whole life we ain't going to make the C-Path 21. So most of these young men, they don't even see a future. So they have no fear. They don't have nothing to lose. They don't have jobs. They don't have careers, big houses, cars. They're scared to lose. A lot of these guys, they're scared to fight because they're scared to lose government possessions. My generation, a lot of people don't even have those possessions and don't have those fruits because from the day they was born, they was never given anything and they wasn't taught anything more than, oh, you're nothing. You're a thug. You're a killer. You're a gangster. You're nobody. So that's the mentality. So there is no fear. There is no, you know what I'm saying, that civil rights, that whole movement, that whole generation, they were brought up under so much oppression and so much fear. Yeah, we were part of a lot of oppression too, but it's a difference in our generation. That's not a lot of fear because we already, like I said, my whole biggest thing was when we are fighting each other, killing each other, no one's screaming peace, no one's screaming stop guys, stop the violence, calm down, let's pray, let's march, blah, blah, blah. But when we all come together as brothers and sisters and fight back against the real enemy, everybody wants to chill out, and I don't think that's cool.
Wow. Well, you know what? Thank you so much, Dorian, for taking the time out tonight to be with us, and we do commend you for your courage. And for all of us who didn't have the courage before, you have definitely spoke to my inner courage to stand up now, because I think the timing is right, and I think you all gotten the attention of the world, and I know myself that I'm no longer walking the fear that I had once I saw you guys on the front line doing what you did.
Yes.
So we take our hats off to you and commend you for what you did. Thank you so much for calling in tonight.
Kerry, before Dorian get off, Dorian, this is Zaki Baruti.
It's
I was
Darren,
one of the brothers.
It's Darren Seals. I go by King B. Seals, but my name is Darren Seals.
Darren, can you give me a call? This is Zaki Baruti a little later on when you can, 422-4629.
Okay. I'll take the number for you, Darren,
if you can send me your number through text, I'll be able to call you around 10:30 on the next break.
Okay,
I'll take the number down for you, Darren.
I'll give you his information, Zaki, Mr. Baruti. Would that
okay,
work,
then, good.
Mr. Bill?
Okay. Thank
all
you,
right.
guys.
Okay.
I appreciate the service support.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Baruti, that was one of the young protesters who's out there and they're fearless. How does that make you feel being one of the organizers out there as well on the front line? What does it feel like to have the young blood out there that's just not afraid anymore like so many people have been since the Civil Rights Movement. You know, after Dr. King died, the Civil Rights Movement died down. Now it feels like it's firing back up.
Well, you know what? That was one of the most exhilarating feelings that I've had down through the years in terms of seeing the young brothers on the street as they were very militantly and defying the militarized police. I mean, I was just overwhelmed with the kind of youthful new leadership that was arising. And so that gives for me as an elder who's 66 years old, who's been involved in the movement for over 45 years, just hope for the future of our people, especially as they develop the kind of political consciousness that needs to be developed where they can see the interconnections of what's happening across the planet, the globe, and see how this country is oppressing people, not just here in Ferguson, not just in the state of Missouri, not just in the United States, but across the globe. And we began to connect the dots and understand this is a struggle for black people throughout the world. And as they develop to that level, I just have great hope and pray that before I have my last breath, that God bless us to have liberation in my lifetime. So it was a great feeling. I've met a number of young people who have shown great leadership characteristics. And also, as he said, if it were not for those young brothers taken to the streets like they did, you would have had another dead body, another brother who would have been case just put into the back files and nothing happened. This occurs day in and day out, not only in the St. Louis area, but all across this country. And to that end, I represent an organization that's called the Universal African People's Organization, and we were part of a larger group here in the St. Louis area fighting the same kind of cases that happened with Michael Brown called the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression. So we've been in the trenches over the years dealing with high-profile cases, but in this instance, it was a phenomenon in terms of the kind of outrage that manifest itself that took off to such a great level that you had press that was coming in from Japan, from Al Jazeera, from Canada, Australia. This was a worldwide event. But the most important thing and the lesson out of this that I keep saying to people that this is a protracted struggle. We got some real deep, serious issues around police violence that we got to address. The number one thing that I personally have always said in front of the press is that you got too many white police officers in the black community. In fact, they serve as like an occupying force. So one of the key things that we have to be pushing for as we move into the future to try to realign the policing in our community is that we got to push for community control of the police. And when I say community control of the police, that means that, first of all, whoever patrols your community should be reflective of the population of that community, the ethnicity of that community. So instead of like in Ferguson, and it's not just in Ferguson, it's in many other communities, you have a black population of 67%, a police force of 53%, commissioned officers, only three are black. That's madness. So that 67% population should have had at least 67% of the police force being black, as well as all officers should live in the communities to which they patrol. So that's a key thing that we got to be pushing for. The second thing that we have to be pushing for is the establishment of civilian review boards with effective subpoena powers, so that when there's complaint of physical or a verbal abuse by officers patrolling our communities, that it is thoroughly investigated by citizens of the community and punishment, of course, coming out of that. Those are the two critical things, along with, as the brother said, we got to push for economic empowerment of our people. We have always said as an organization that the billions of dollars that's been spent in war armaments And in fact, the first day that the killing occurred, and when I came on the scene, I was just struck by the presence of over, looked like 100 militarized fleets, along with vehicles that was as if like you was in Iraq. You know, it was a war in Iraq, along with the police dogs and what have you. So it's about reordering the priorities of this country. Instead of spending billions of dollars to aid countries like Israel and also oppress the Palestinians, those billions of dollars need to be reinvested here in America in the urban areas where a lot of people are living, similar to what they did in Europe after World War II, where they had what was called the Marshall Plan, and they spent billions of dollars to rebuild the European cities that had been destroyed during World War II. Same thing needs to happen right here, and that's the kind of consciousness that we got to be pushing out there as we move forward. And my last thing in terms of what needs to happen, we have to have a human rights movement instead of civil rights. And along with the human rights movement, black people got to begin to wake up and seize political power. And when I say seize political power, we always push the concept of proportionate political representation, meaning that whatever percentage we are as a people on the national level, state level, and local level, we should have that percentage of political power as it relates to office holders and what have you, that then can lend to us building economically. Because if you look at America politically, just like in Ferguson, black people are 13% of the population. But if you look at all the elected officials across this country, which is over 500,000, we only hold about 3%. If you look at the United States Senate, 100 senators, 3 are only black. We should have at least 13 United States senators. We should have at least 6 black governors. Those are the tasks that's before our people as we try to change these power relationships.
I absolutely agree 100%. Mr. Edward Crawford, your photo has gone across the world. That night, we just want you to set the stage. What was going on that night? You all were out there. You were protesting. What was going on before that photo was taken?
Well, before that photo was taken, there was a lot of shouting. You had people on bullhorns. Basically, it was just a regular protest. It was a peaceful protest. No one was being belligerent, you know, or negative towards the movement. Everyone was seen to be on point with what we wanted to get established, and that was getting our voices heard and trying to get something done, get justice. Once our voices are heard, people get interested and, you know, they want to dig deeper, and that shines light on other issues and other things that need to be taken care of and changed. So that's all that was going on that night, the night I was there. I was out there 2 nights. The night before then, the picture was taken, and that night. So that's what was going on then.
So for anybody who does not know who he is, let me tell you, you've probably seen the photo, you just didn't know this is who it is. Mr. Crawford is the man you saw with the braids on, with the flag-like shirt on, what were you throwing back, a can of tear gas or throwing the tear gas because it almost hit a child or something like that?
Yes, it was tear gas. It was a tear gas canister.
And it almost hit a child?
Yes, they shot it into the crowd that we were standing in. They shot it into the crowd. And there were children around and women as well.
So what propelled you to decide you're going to throw it back in the other direction?
My fatherly instinct, I guess. That's all it was. Because my main focus was getting it away from the kids. There were kids out there, and tear gas is very strong. It affects your breathing, your vision. It irritates the skin. So that's nothing that you would think a kid would want to go through. I mean, I never want to see a kid get hit by tear gas or be affected by tear gas.
Right. And tear gas, by the way, for anyone who doesn't know, was banned in 1993. It's considered a chemical weapon. So it's not even I'm sorry?
No, yeah, that's, I was just agreeing with you. It's chemical. It's a chemical weapon.
It's a chemical weapon. Stand by, Mr. Crawford. I'm going to come back to you. We got another 314-600. Good evening. You're on center stage.
This is Gerald Christmas. How you doing?
Hi. This is Mr. Christmas. He's the attorney for Mr. Crawford. Good evening. How are you this Friday evening? As we talk about Crawford, Ferguson, you're down there and you're an attorney and you deal with a lot of tickets in Ferguson. We understand that every household has about 3 warrants on it. Is that the case in Ferguson?
Statistically, I don't know if that's the case. I know they have a significant number of warrants. You know, Ferguson took in about $2.8 million last year from traffic violations. So I know a significant number of people in Ferguson pay traffic fines, and the majority of those are African Americans because they have a history of racial profiling in Ferguson and the other surrounding municipalities in the area.
So is it, you know, we know that there's a movement down there, the group, I forgot what it stands for, Missourians Organizing, I forgot what the acronym more stands for, but they're basically working to get rid of those nonviolent tickets down there. Is that likely for someone like you who works in the system, is that likely to happen?
Honestly, I don't think it's likely to happen. You know, we're going to have to have a shakeup with the entire municipal system. A lot of people think that, you know, there's Ferguson is somewhat separate from the St. Louis metropolitan area, but the St. Louis metropolitan area is made up of 91 municipalities, very much similar to Ferguson, and we have to address the entire system. If you look at the Washington Post today, they did an excellent article on the municipal system in the St. Louis metropolitan area, and we have to attack that entire system.
Mm-hmm. Attack the entire system. And how do you go about that, though? When you say attack the entire system, how are you going to do that?
Well, what we want to do is bring the Justice Department in to investigate those municipalities that have a history of racial profiling and look to see if we can change some of the policies that they're doing with the intensive policing of the African-American community. We want to see if they can do something about the excessive fines that they set. A lot of times they set fines. They don't allow people to go on payment plans. They want them to pay the balance off in full. A lot of times individuals go warrant and they go to jail, and when they bond out, they don't get any credit for jail time. So we want to look at if we can have some changes in that. The municipalities have the ability to suspend your driver's license if you fail to appear in court. I don't believe that these small municipalities should have the ability to suspend your driver's license, because then that complicates the situation even more, because driving with a suspended license is another 12-point violation in Missouri, which suspends your license for an additional year. So we'd like to take a look at that. We'd like them to take into consideration the income of the individuals in the municipalities when they're setting these fines. We'd also like to look at the diversity of the prosecutor and the judges in these municipalities, along with diversifying the police forces.
Well, let me ask you something before we move on. I saw on the news the other day on CBS Evening News where Waldo, Florida, basically, in my opinion, had a lot of similar things going on to what's going on in Ferguson. Basically, they had a population of 1,000 people. They had 12,000 tickets that they wrote last year. They had collected some $400,000 in fines, and basically one-third of the city's revenue was collected from those tickets. Would you say Ferguson is a whole lot like a Waldo, Florida?
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. And you have many municipalities that surround Ferguson that are the same way. I know you're in Dallas, but you really need to take a visit to St. Louis so we can take you around and show you the area, and you can see that there are many Fergusons in this area. Michael Brown happened in Ferguson, and that was the catalyst, but it could have happened in University City, Maryland Heights, Richmond Heights, Bell Ridge, Bell North, Normandy, any of those surrounding municipalities. The same thing is happening, and a lot of places across the country, we're having these same problems.
Wow. Okay, stand by, Mr. Christmas. We're going to go to 314-853. Good evening. You're on center stage. 314-853.
Yes,
hello.
Is this Ms. Hines?
It is.
How you doing, Ms. Hines?
I'm good.
This is Prisoner of Love. How you doing, Mr. Gerald Christmas and Zaki Peruti?
How you doing there?
I'm doing. You remember me?
Yeah, I do. Prisoner, yes, you know I do.
Yeah. Yeah, Ms. Hines, did you ever check out what I asked you on YouTube, Black Life Prisoner of Love?
You know, I believe our very good researcher, Mr. Mark Daniels, checked on that. Mark Daniels, didn't you check on that for us?
I most certainly did, and it's good to hear you calling back in, Mr. Prisoner. I did check it out. I did my research, and I was very, very disturbed by what I read and what I saw about what happened. And the fact that that sort of information, I wasn't aware of it until you brought it to my attention, amazes me.
Was that Oklahoma 1921?
That's right. That's right. The Wall Street.
Black Wall Street, yeah.
Black Wall Street and what they did to the people in that community. They were people were just shot down, murdered in the streets. The whole community was ravaged. And this was one of the most affluent black neighborhoods in the nation at the time.
And that was horrendous.
Yeah, it was. It was. And
if people
really
talk about
the
looting that happened during the Ferguson protest, but they seem to forget how the white community treated us when all we wanted to do was live peacefully together and ask for basic human rights. We were blown up. We were killed. Dogs were sicked on us, water hoses. Our children were killed, and people are raised in hell because some people went in and took some rims and some hair products. It doesn't even compare to the horrors that have been expressed on black people who just wanted basic human rights.
And you know what? The thing about that is, the thing about that is they call that a race riot. That was not a race riot, and I hope people understand that. That was a massacre. It was just like what they did to the Indians. It was a massacre. But, see, that's how they try to clean that stuff up, call it another. It was like black folks went and got their guns, and it was a race riot. No, that was a massacre, if you really pay attention to it and see what was really going on. And, this is me. I don't think race, anything that you benefit from, you're not going to give it up. White folks in power benefit from racism and discrimination. Would you agree with that?
Of course. That's even the prison industrial industry is based on the exploitation. We like cannon fodder. And then the beneficiaries of us being locked up is, first of all, many of the construction companies that build the prisons. Then you got people who service the prisons. But then if you look at the officers who work in the community who arrest us, being predominantly white, they benefit. Then when you go to the courts, you got the judges and many of the attorneys are white. They benefit. The stenographers benefit. So it's almost like like Jim Crow or a new form of slavery based on the incarceration of us as people. So, yeah, they benefit. This is a great economic system that benefits on that. I mean,
Mr. Christmas, you and I were just talking about this. When we were sitting in your truck.
And see, they are not going to get this up. I believe myself that this police is going to get away with this. This is how racist.
The officer is not going to be indicted. That's not going to happen. I only hope it's going to be in the U.S. Attorney's Office. There's not going to be an indictment at the state level.
Uh-huh.
But you know what? The power of life and death is in the tongue, and y'all are already speaking into that situation the wrong way. Shouldn't we be speaking that he's going to be indicted?
Well, I've been a prosecutor before, and I know how the grand jury works. And normally when we go into the grand jury to get an indictment on a homicide, we get that done in one day. When you start convening a grand jury before you finish the investigation, you're setting it up for a no true bill. Remember, the grand jury is only for probable cause. All you determine is, do we have the right person? Are we charging them correctly? And do we have probable cause to move forward? Over probably 98% of the time, we get our indictments in the grand jury. The grand jury is an arm of the prosecution. The joke in the prosecutor's office is that you can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. What the prosecutor in St. Louis County is doing now is that he's presenting so much evidence to them at this point that by the time they get ready to vote as to whether or not to true bill this case or not, meaning to indict it, they're going to vote to no true bill. I know that from my experience being a prosecutor, and he knows it too. And then he's going to say, well, the grand jury did that, not me. And that's what prosecutors do when they want to hide behind the grand jury and not issue charges. And when you say you're going to invite the defendant to come in and speak, we never bring the defendant into the grand jury. Most defense attorneys would never bring the defendant into the grand jury because you don't want your client to be cross-examined by the prosecutor and you can't be present in there because it's a secret process. But in this case, this officer has had the opportunity to conform his story to the evidence. So they're bringing him into the grand jury so he can ingratiate himself to them. And we know this grand jury is made up of 9 whites and 3 blacks. And you need 9 votes in order to indict. So hypothetically, even if the 3 African-Americans voted to indict, they would still need 6 whites to come along with them in order to get 9 votes. And I don't see an indictment happening.
Oh, my goodness.
And at best, if you did get an indictment, it would be on involuntary manslaughter. Murder first and murder second are off the table. I don't see that happening at all. Involuntary manslaughter is a C felony in Missouri, which means it's open to probation. And I think even if you had a jury trial on involuntary manslaughter in St. Louis County, the way the county is made up, that the officer would be found not guilty. So I don't see anything happening at the state level from my legal experience working
Gerald,
with both the prosecutor's office and the defense side.
Gerald, can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
You're a lawyer, right?
Yes, sir.
Tell me this. Why is it that when a priest rape a little 7 or 8 year old boy, they don't go to jail? Why would the Pope try to cover that up? Tell me that.
Well, I can't give you the answer to that. That's in the doctrine of the Catholic Church. I mean, generally, if you charge with a sex crime and sex offenders, to be honest with you, because I prosecuted sex crimes in the prosecutor's office, they get dealt with more harshly than people that commit homicide at the state level. Because, you know, you're a registered sex offender for life. You know, once you label a sex offender, you have a hard road to toe for the rest of your life. You'd be better off killing somebody than being labeled a sex offender.
Well, do the priests get labeled a sex offender?
If they're charged and convicted.
I think, aren't we getting off the subject?
Right.
The subject is focusing on Ferguson.
No, I think all of this stuff should be talked about. I don't know who said that.
I said it. Yeah. Keeper Rudy said it. I said because the issue at hand is the police
violence. I understand that, Zaki. But you got to put all your cards on the table, man. It just shows how racist and how much power that these people have. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
But that's, we have laid that out earlier.
And you know, gentlemen, I am one of the panelists. What I kind of wanted to say, and I know we're talking about Ferguson and the dynamics of the civil unrest and the protest. The question I have is this: in terms of alluding to police officers and their veil of invisibility they have when they are evidently and even proven in a court of law for misconduct is prosecutorial immunity. I'm in Illinois, and I mentioned last week that I'm currently fighting a wrongful arrest, and I'm also fighting one of the U.S. codes that basically deals with prosecutorial immunity. And I had to go through the whole criminal process, never had been in trouble with the law. But I said all that to say this. if we're going to take a snapshot of Ferguson, one of the things that I know on the table would help in the future is going to be lowering the standard of the partial or total prosecutorial immunity that state's attorneys, district attorneys, and that police have. One of the problems becomes is that you're absolutely right. My attorney at the time never even told me that I could have went before the grand jury, so I didn't even know that as a defendant. And the other thing that I'll just say on that is that I think until we deal with that U.S. Code 42 and that we do something where basically it's not the civil servant's word against the citizens, and they basically 99.9% of the time that they win. We've got to do something so when it is proven, and then I know that's the another thing with the charging action by the district or the state's attorney, and basically they're the ones that can say, we don't want to charge this individual, even though it is. But the more noise you make, and then I think if that law can be reexamined and possibly overturned and changed, when a police officer is caught beyond a shadow of a doubt in misconduct, then they should be held to the same standard that I would in terms of criminal or punitive litigation against them. And I think that's a problem, and I think we do have to continue to beat the drum and make the noise. But some of these laws that are racist in nature and disproportionately unfair, as a black community, we have to realize that without that law element, all we're going to do is make noise, because at the end of the day, if we don't push some people and vote some people in and then address the laws that allow prosecutorial immunity, that basically police can lie, they can cheat, they can withhold evidence, they can pretty much do anything they want to do and then either not be charged by the state's attorney, or once they are charged, then it's probably going to be something reduced. So I think that the standard that I'm held to as a citizen should almost be the same as the police, so that they don't get total immunity.
I agree 100%. I think these protests are so timely, and I think, you know, all things work together for the good. It is so unfortunate that Mike Brown lost his life. However, I think it's going to be the catalyst for change. I think Mike Brown's death has awakened the sleeping giant in all of us. I think we realize that there's an issue with police brutality that has got to be addressed. I think we got to look at the fact that police accountability has got to it's got to be raised a little higher than this. We can't just allow, you know, police departments to run amok, do whatever they want to do, and no one hold them accountable because they have a badge and a gun. That's just not acceptable anymore. I think we got to do that. And you know, at first, I heard people say, well, you know, when you go into a situation like this, there's going to be some casualties. And at first, I thought, you know, no, nobody has to die. But, you know, I titled this show Mike Brown's Protesters Willing to Die for Justice. And I kind of feel like, you know what, if it happens, it would be unfortunate. But I don't think we're going to get out of this without some bloodshed, and I hate to say that, but I really feel that I think this thing has been derailed so long that they're not going to just willfully come along and say, you know what, you're right, we should be accountable when we shoot someone who isn't doing anything and who is unarmed and who is just basically jaywalking in the middle of the street or selling Lucy cigarettes or just standing after he broke up a fight. I don't think they're just going to willfully say, okay, we're going to be accountable now. I don't think they're going to do that. So I think we're going to have to demand change. And
let
I demand just, again. I'm sorry.
I was just going to just echo what you said. And also moving forward, there is a determined group of people, including Brother Gerald Christmas and other members of our Justice for Michael Brown Leadership Coalition that have determined to keep protesting going, to do a number of disruptions. In fact, we have on the table stopping traffic on highway one of the highways this coming Wednesday, September the 10th, along with a number of other actions. And also we'll be including advocating for economic sanctions against different companies as part of our demands, as well as going back to the voting thing. Number one, we are determined to get rid of the mayor and the fire chief, I mean police chief, and one of the things that we'll be putting on the tape and taking to the people is the recall of the current mayor, which Gerald can he just got elected in April with only, what, about 10 to 15% voter turnout. But since this is a carrot and the people are outraged, we're looking at getting enough petitions to, as I said, recall them, and that would probably be turned in around December, because that's the earliest that we can do that. And so the actions are moving forward, and we cannot accept the status quo anymore. Enough is enough. And, in fact, we've been, prior to Michael Brown, we were pushing for what we call a civilian review board in the city of St. Louis, had gotten it passed by the Board of Aldermen, and a racist mayor of St. Louis, Francis Slay, vetoed it. Then we tried to get them unseated through election, but our people didn't turn out. So, again, that speaks to the task before us. We got to educate our people about the necessity of voting so that they can have an influence on the politics as to who patrol your community.
I agree. I think, you know what, though? I think, and I know this is not a black issue only, but I think in terms of, you know, who, you know, ends up being shot by police most often, it's people of color. And I think black people have got to stand up. And I think, you know, it's not a time in which, and I said this on the previous show, it's not a time in which you stand in the window and say, you know, y'all doing a good job. No, you got to come out on the porch. And if you're scared, then at least you need to pray. But everybody needs to be doing something. I mean, and I think we got to hold everybody accountable. You know, we don't really want to believe that everybody is afraid. Everybody ain't afraid. Everybody has a skill set. Use your skill set if that's in the background helping them write, you know, petitions, or if that's in the background helping do something. Maybe you don't want your face out front because you'll lose your job. But, you know, Joel and I talked about this earlier, but everybody can still do something from behind the scene.
And,
so,
and I think that's what's important. You got to. We have to encourage everyone to use their skill set, and for us to work together as best we can to move our community forward and quit identifying individuals for what they're not doing, because everybody's reality is different, and we just got to figure out how we can bring everybody on board instead of trying to separate ourselves. And for the young people, I respect the young lions and the young soldiers out there in their courage, but I want them to also remember it has always been young people that have moved our movement. This is not the first time that we've had a movement that was led by young people. I talked to my parents when they were deep in the civil rights movement. Those were young children going to jail. We've always had young people pushing the envelope. One of the reasons why is because young people are the most available to push the envelope. We have them in the larger numbers. They have less responsibilities and less ties, so they're much able to push the envelope. And we really need our young people to step up across the board, you know, not only just those soldiers that are out here on the streets in Ferguson, but where are all our young people in the music industry? You know, most of black, unfortunately, you know, black culture is driven by its music. And, you know, that music is taking our kids to the gutter. That's one of the problems why we got so many in the prison industry. I was in the club in Atlanta. You know, the DJ said, all my N's, put your hands up. Then he said, all my B's, put your hands up. And all the women threw their hands up. It's like, really? We didn't got to this point that it's just common that women going to refer to themselves as B's and throw their hands up in the club? If I'd have been in a Hispanic or an Asian or a Caucasian club, they would have been offended by that. So it's like Malcolm X said, you know, we got to wake up, clean up, and stand up, you know, and that's what needs to happen across the board, young and old.
I agree.
Well
said,
girl.
I think you're right. Where has hip-hop been in that? I mean, a couple of them have dropped records, you know, Diddy and 50 Cent did something, you know, different, but in terms of...
They need to drop some money. They got some money. They can drop some money, and they can channel some energy to this movement. Yeah. They can be down. They can get in town on Wednesday and help us shut this highway down. You know, if Diddy come in here and help us shut this highway down, or 50 Cent, or Floyd Mayweather or Nicki Minaj or any of these people out here that, you know, they feeding all this gutter music to our kids, you know, making them think they can tap their face up and still get a job. Or where is Drake at? Started from the bottom where now I'm here. He ain't started from the bottom of nothing, but it's cool. You know, they're fooling our children.
Where is Nelly at? Nelly is from that community. Is that not correct?
Well, Nelly, he made one brief appearance. I was down on the protest line down on West Florida Avenue. He came in and he did speak to the number of folks that gathered around him. And, you know, he projected the need for voting and using your economics, but he hasn't been back. That was that one-time appearance. But like Gerald just mentioned, Christmas just mentioned, they could be doing a whole lot more. And if they're too afraid to get on the front line, they can be putting some money into the community so that we can be, for those who's been on the front line and have a history of being on the front line, and then they can fund candidates that would best represent us, like Brother Gerald Christmas himself had ran for the prosecuting attorney, City of St. Louis, because we had a racist prosecuting attorney with herself being predominantly white. So everyone, going back to that whole issue, everyone can make a contribution. But people, but then to the other side of it, folks got to understand that the problem is impacting everyone. And any of those entertainers, and many of them have been jailed on some bull, has a responsibility of us as a community. And like Gerald said, a lot of that filth got to be, we got to have a campaign against all that filth that they be projecting, as well as those songs encouraging violence in our community. All of that got to be challenged, and preferably with this new movement, that will come about in the near future.
You know what, let's go back to what Gerald said earlier when he said he thought the officer would not be indicted. Let's fast forward to the day that could possibly happen. What will that do to change the movement in Ferguson?
It's going to be like throwing gasoline on a fire. It's going to blow up.
Ooh, that's what I'm afraid of. That's what I'm afraid of. I don't know if you all know what Dick Gregory said. Dick Gregory came to Ferguson for a couple of days. And Dick Gregory said when he was on his way to the airport, he told his brothers, he was driving them, he said, listen, I want you to go home and get some canned goods and put them away because this might be the big one. And so,
I believe that.
Wow.
I saw a generator on sale in the grocery store yesterday, and I was thinking I need to get my money together and get me a generator and give me some supplies, because I think you need to start preparing yourself for that event.
Okay, so, Gerald, how quickly are we talking about this could all happen in terms of, you know, the indictment process or lack thereof? How quickly does that happen?
Under normal circumstances, as I indicated, we get an indictment done in one day. You know, when I worked in the prosecutor's office, we get an indictment done on a homicide in one day, just a couple of hours. Sometimes it might drag on for a day or two if a witness wasn't available. Remember, we're only determining probable cause in the grand jury. We're not trying the case in the grand jury. We're just determining if we have probable cause. That's a very low hurdle. Bob McCullough, the prosecutor in this case, indicating that he should have some results from the grand jury in October. And the reason why we're asking for Bob McCullough to be removed from this case, I'll give you a little quick history. Bob McCullough, his father was a police officer who was killed in the line of duty in the housing development here in St. Louis years ago, and he was killed by an African-American. After his father was killed, his mother had to then take care of the family, and she was given a job in the police department as a clerk in the homicide division. Then his brother became a police officer. Bob McCullough wanted to be a police officer, but he had a bout with cancer, and he had to have his leg removed. He wears a prosthesis. And then his uncle is a police officer, and then his first cousin is also a police officer who was charged with police brutality for assaulting a retarded guy during an arrest. That case was prosecuted in St. Louis City. It was moved to Kansas City for change of venue, and his brother was not convicted. So he has a long, very close relationship with the police department. And if Bob McCullough was sitting on a jury panel and we were voir dire trying to decide who we were going to sit on this jury for this case, he would not be chosen because of his ties to the police. He's too closely tied to police officers to think that he could sit on a case and be fair and impartial. And he's also too closely tied to the police to think that he's going to vigorously prosecute a police officer. It's just not going to happen.
Wow. So the only person that can remove him is the governor, we understand.
Not now. The governor could have removed him when he had a state of emergency, but he's withdrawn the state of emergency, so he no longer has the power to do it. So at this point, the only way that Bob McCullough can be removed is if he voluntarily recuses himself, and he's indicated that he's not going to do that.
And he's indicated that in the face of over 70,000 signatures that was brought to his office through the efforts of State Senator Jamila Nasheed. So he's just saying the hell with black folks. That's the bottom line. As well as
we have to be.
And the governor.
And we have to be strong enough to stand up to that, because he's strong enough to say what his position is. He even told the governor that if you want me gone, then you man up and remove me. And I agree with him on that point. The governor should have manned up and removed him.
But he was a coward. He was a coward. So that's what we face with, the entire arrogance of the white power structure. So we have to do – it's like when some black leaders during 1940, A. Philip Randolph met with at that time the president, Franklin Roosevelt, about blacks not being hired in the various war industries, and the president acknowledged that's the reality. Then he said, now make me do it. I mean, you know, to the essence, now what you gonna do? So it's on us as a community.
We have to organize, and that's why we have to have economic funding and organization. One of the reasons why the governor was reluctant to remove Bob McCullough is because of the Fraternal Order of Police. The Fraternal Order of Police is a very strong organization in the state of Missouri and across the country. They support political candidates with a lot of financial contributions, and they also organize and bring out a lot of votes. Most politicians do not want to cross the Fraternal Order of Police. And we have to start organizing, and also not only in holding political positions, but we have to start developing economics in our community. We have to stop depending on God and white folk to do for us what we can do for ourselves. We have the ability to spend our money in our community and rotate our dollars in our community, save money in our community, support banks in our community. You know, we have to really focus on what we can do for ourselves and quit depending on other people to do for us.
If you just tuned in, you come to the stage tonight. We're talking about the topic, Mike Brown protesters willing to die for justice. If you have a question or a comment, get on the phone line. Call us at the 347-850-8390. Then press 1 once connected. If you're on the phone lines now, and there's quite a few callers on the phone lines, if you have a question or a comment, you have to press 1 for us to know that we need to come to you. But that's what we're talking about tonight, the protesters, the people who have basically been out front, basically got the attention of the world, and basically put the spotlight on police brutality across the globe. And we so commend them tonight for their courage. And one thing I noticed, that everything positive the protesters did, there was a negative backlash. You know, when the protesters were out there and they were peaceful, then we heard stories of looting. Can someone address the issue of the looting and explain who was responsible for the looting and how or whether or not that was connected to the protesters or not?
Let me say this. I was there on the night that they're supposed to have kicked off. The police, I call it liberate. I'm sorry, people call it looting. That's not even the issue. The issue is the murder of Michael Brown. But the reality is that 15 or 20 feet from where the you know, the militarized police were holding the line. You could see people going into the stores, but they did nothing to stop them, and that was for a purpose. That was for a purpose. That was to try to, and they knew the cameras was out there, that was to kind of project us in a negativity, so to shift the issue out of the murder of Mike Brown, which is symbolic of the murders of our young black youth all across this country, to saying, look at those wild people, and then try to tie in that that's a justification for killing Mike Brown. In fact, one of our early demands was that the killer cop be identified publicly. When they finally did it because of all the pressure, then they released a video as if Mike Brown was doing some type of strong arm robbery. Our position is, if he even if he had done robbery, he had his hands up in the air, according to numerous witnesses. So it was no reason, no justification for the murder. So that looting is just a tactic to take off the heat from the murderous attitude of that Darren Wilson, which is reflective of, and I've said this publicly on a number of occasions, that the KKK has taken off their white sheets, and many of them have joined the police forces of America, and they're conducting what I call legalized lynchings. And it's upon us to identify that as such. And again, I reemphasize that the objective of this movement in the end run all across this country is that we need to have community control of the police departments and rid those departments of the disproportionate number of white officers and have every community police force reflective of the ethnicity of that community, and every officer that work on the police force live in that community. That, in my humble estimation, I mean, in my humble opinion, has to be one of the driving forces as relates to police and our community.
The people that were taking the
I wanted to add one thing to what, was that Mr. Christmas speaking?
Yeah, no, that was me speaking.
Okay.
Just now, I was just saying that the people that were removing the items from the stores that you saw on camera, they were just rebelling against the lack of investment by the city in that community and how that community has used them in order to grow, but they have not invested back in them. They have not invested in them from an educational standpoint, from a job standpoint, and from a business standpoint. And what you saw when they were going in those stores was their frustration from the lack of attention that they've seen. And if it had not, if they had not shown that frustration, we would not be on this radio show now talking if that had not happened. So that needed to happen.
Yeah, I just wanted to add this one thing, because I was watching from my home the events unfold in Ferguson on live streams, where I was able to see things happening that weren't being reported on the corporate-owned media. And what I saw was agent provocateurs on the ground. I saw people that were most likely members of law enforcement that were out there trying to mix in with the protesters, and they were engaged in looting, and they were encouraging other people to loot. What I saw the citizens, the residents of Ferguson doing was calling people out and telling them to stop. That's what I saw happening. And that's something you're not going to hear about on the corporate-owned media.
Well, that we began to speak to that right after that happened. You're absolutely right. There were a number of agent provocateurs, and you had different folks with different motives mixed among the people who were expressing their righteous indignation. But, you know, that's part of the whole – if you go back to the – even to the 60s, you know, you had the program, COINTEL program, where agents of the FBI would infiltrate different organizations to foster division among, you know, the various organizations that were seeking some social justice for us. So without a doubt there were agent provocateurs, as you just mentioned, among the crowd. But then that's the test that we got to understand, that as we fight for social change, is that people have to go into, like the biblical scripture, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. And that's the kind of attitude that, you know, we have to engage ourselves in.
And I wanted to ask, if I may, I wanted to ask both Mr. Christmas and Mr. Baruti a question. Because, you know, I come at this from, you know, I'm not African-American, and I wanted to, and I'm very, you know, I'm trying to educate myself more about the black struggle in America and learn more about what it is that seeing it from your perspective. And one of the things I wanted to ask you was, are there white people there in your communities that you're working with that are working with you? And if not, why not?
It is. There are. Now, this incident, again, you know, as far as my involvement, we've been speaking on police violence way long time. There was a most outstanding case called Marilyn Banks in 1984, where a young African mother was sitting on her porch and a white officer was chasing a black youth who he knew, a female, shot at her and missed her and shot Marilyn Banks and killed her. So there's been people on the forefront, including white people, that's been part of speaking out against racial violence. In fact, a number of our allies, we do have white allies, and we welcome any person or any ethnicity that or have a consciousness for seeking out social justice. And by the way, my favorite hero in terms of historical past was John Brown, who did what he had to do in terms of picking up arms on behalf of our enslaved brothers and sisters, or people like William Lloyd Garrison. These were men of consciousness, and we have a white, of the white race that was conscious about the plight of our people. And we have some that's with us today that has that same attitude. And, in fact, there was a delegation of people from Washington, D.C., which was a predominantly white anti-war organization. They sent a delegation of people to be supportive of us. So surely we do welcome progressive-minded white people or any people of any race to help us in this cause.
Well, and I also read a news report about a Tea Party organization who came there and went to local businesses to shop and to show their support. You know, it was a small gesture, and they weren't seeking any recognition, but somebody noticed it, and there was a report done about it. And so, I want to see more people unite across racial lines, across, and try to erase some of these barriers, you know, that are dividing people, because we all know who the real enemy is, and they're mostly white, very at the very top, very wealthy, what some people call global elites that are ruling the world. And as Mr. Baruti talked about at the beginning, about how this is something that goes across the globe. And with the militarization of police, more and more you're seeing whites, blacks, no matter what your race is, being victims of police brutality.
You hit it right on the head. The real issue is deep capitalism. At the top of the heap is really probably basically all white, though, super rich men, but predominantly, that exploit the masses of people, including poor white people, and they have the mechanism to propagandize people against each other so that they can stay in power. Poor whites who maintain that racist attitude really are driven many times by the attitudes of various propaganda machinery like the radio talk host, Russ Limbaugh, that kind of mad mentality that's projected out there. And so as long as the poor people fight against each other, the super rich go to sleep with the super abundance of wealth that they have gotten off the labor of the people.
It's the classic divide and conquer strategy that's been used throughout history.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Let me ask you a question to address something Mr. Verruti said earlier. Let's be clear on what robbery really is. What they said or accused or alleged that Mike Brown did, that's not even really considered robbery, is it?
Well, we don't have strong-arm robbery in Missouri. We have either robbery first or robbery second. And robbery first is when you commit an instrument. Robbery second would be with the use of force. Now, technically, from what I saw on the video, Mike Brown could have been charged with robbery second for that because of the way that when he picked up the cigarillos that fell out the box from the floor, and then when he was confronted by the gentleman that works in the store, the way he collared him and pushed him back, and then the way he approached him before he exited the door, as a prosecutor, you could charge him with robbery second for that. Now, in Missouri, that's a Class B felony. And I'm going to tell you honestly, with him being 18 and a first-time offender, he probably would have gotten probation if he had been convicted of that robbery second. More than likely, he would have gotten probation, would have been ordered to go to school, get a job, maybe do some anger management counseling, pay back restitution for the items that were stolen. That's the extent of probably what would have happened with that. And he probably would have gotten what's called a SIS in Missouri, which is a suspended imposition of sentence, which means that when you complete your probation, the record will be closed and you can legally say that you've never been convicted of a crime before. So most certainly he wouldn't have got the death penalty for that.
And let's be clear, you know, a lot of people were trying to seek Mike Brown's juvenile records through the open records request, and it came back this week that he had no prior juvenile record. A lot of people were, for some reason, interested in that, as though that had anything to do with why Darren Wilson, you know, shot and killed him in the street. The two have nothing to do with each other. And we also know that Darren Wilson, at the time that he shot Mike Brown, was not even aware of what allegedly occurred at the store. So
exactly. At the time that he confronted Mike Brown, all he knew was that he was walking in the middle of the street, and he had observed two cars that had to go around him in order to continue down the street. So the first thing he said when he approached Mike Brown was, get the F out the street. See, one of the problems with policing is that white officers and black police officers police differently. You know, white officers many times have this attitude that it's us against them, whereas black officers police in the sense that we're all in this community together. And so that's the difference. And in reference to the juvenile records, as attorneys, we really have to stand strong on that, because your juvenile record is a sealed record. That should not have even come up as a conversation as to thing regarding his juvenile record, because what you do at the juvenile level is a sealed record, and that has been standing precedent in this country for over 50 years. And we cannot back down on that point, and we don't even want to open up that can of worms that we're going to start trying to some way look at a juvenile record. What happens at a juvenile is because you are at a different stage, your mentality is at a different stage, the courts recognize that, and that's why that record is a sealed record that cannot be opened under any circumstances in dealing with you as an adult.
Didn't that seem to be like propaganda, though, in terms of trying to bias the grand jury and public opinion? Because oftentimes when police arrest individuals and they don't have a criminal history, they're either going to try and trump something up or they're going to try and muddy the water one way or the other. But the easiest way in terms of future prosecution seems to be bring something up. Or if they do have, whether it's juvenile or a adult criminal record, in some way to bring that up as if, and in some cases it may be related, but it seems like that's, they didn't really have anything, so now let's just say something, even if it's not true, because it seems like the propaganda itself is going to work for them.
And that's exactly what was happening. You're right on point with that. They were just using that as propaganda because they know that the jury pool, if in fact you have to try this case, the jury pool is already out here listening to all of this. So if people are called to sit as possible jurors on this case, those types of things are already on their mind. And that's why it was done that way. That was the rationale for that. You're exactly right.
But, you know, the whole Maul point, though, even if he had a record, even at the extreme, let's just say even the worst extreme, he had his, I mean, you know, in war, when people, combatants, if one side raise up their hand and say, I give, it is duty-bound, supposedly, for folks not to shoot them or take them as prisoners. This man had his hands up in the air saying, don't shoot. I mean, you know, I give up, basically. And the Darren Wilson fired 6 shots into his body.
There was no justification
whatsoever.
None.
And that's where we got to keep our eye on that particular prize, on that focus. There's no kind of justification for it, period.
I also want you guys to think about the other shooting that occurred in St. Louis of Kajami Powell,
right,
where the police officers told a conflicting story saying that he came at them with an overhand motion with a knife, and but for somebody videotaping that, we would be moving forward with the lie that they told. And that story is not getting the traction or attention that it should be getting. They killed that young man in less than 23 seconds. They shot him 12 times, and it was clear that he had a mental issue. People were walking by looking at him saying that was just a crazy guy. Nobody felt threatened or anything. But because we had such a heightened awareness behind Mike Brown, those two white officers showed up fearful. And they immediately jumped out of their car and gunned him down in less than 30 seconds. And if that had been 2 African-American cops, it would have never happened that way. And you really need to dig in and look at that story and look at that video, because that was cold-blooded murder, what they did to that man. And that's more disturbing to me than Mike Brown.
But you know what, Gerald, you just said something. Right, a day after that or 2 days afterwards, it was reported that 2 black officers were confronted in the same situation with a white person. I think he might have been had a knife. I'm not absolutely sure.
He had a knife.
And they tased him. So
exactly.
Obviously, you know, it's a 2 set of values in terms of how we've been saying that all along.
African-American officers are going to do what they can first. They're going to try their best not to use lethal force. Look at the cases across the country. You don't hear about African-American officers shooting down white citizens or black citizens on an epidemic basis. It's always the white officers shooting down African-Americans, and that's what the problem is, because they go to deadly force first, whereas black officers, they look at how we can resolve this situation before we have to use deadly force.
Let me address something you mentioned earlier. You mentioned, they wrote up the report, about that particular shooting, and they said he was coming towards them. They did write a report. However, it was a false report, but they wrote a report. In the case of Darren Wilson shooting Michael Brown, we understand there was no incident report written. We know that he never called dispatch to say he shot someone. We know he never called the EMTs. When does that happen? Or is that the norm?
The norm. That is not the norm, and that's why I'm so grateful that we have Eric Holder in the seat as the U.S. attorney, where they can really come in and examine that. That's not the norm, and that's not how it's supposed to happen. He should have. Once he had the struggle in the car and the gun went off, he should have called for backup then. He should have got on the radio, shots fired, called for backup. Mike Brown was running away. He had the opportunity to get in his car, retreat, chase him, see where he was going, but he should have called for backup. Then as soon as he had this officer firing on the individual. He should have reported that over the radio, and he should have done a report immediately. Now he's taking the fifth and not saying anything, and he's going to go in and testify before the grand jury. This is why I don't feel there's going to be an indictment, because when he goes before that grand jury now, his story is going to go along with all the evidence that he's heard now. He's going to conform his story to fit all of that in order to seek sympathy from that grand jury. That's why Bob McCullough is letting him go in there and talk to the grand jury. Because under normal circumstances, you would not invite the defendant to come to the grand jury. And you can't just come to the grand jury. You have to be subpoenaed to testify before the grand jury or be extended the invitation to testify before the grand jury, because it's a secret process. And that's the problem I have with the way this whole investigation is being conducted by the state prosecutor, and that's exactly why we need to be preparing our people for the fact that there's not going to be an indictment in this case.
Okay, well, you say there's not going to be an indictment. Let's just say hypothetically that happens. But is that it? You mean the state still can't pick up the charges and say, okay, we're still going to move forward with prosecuting this case?
Once the grand jury decides that they are not going to true bill this case, it's going to die right there at the state level. The only possibility for prosecution at that point is going to be at the federal level.
Wow. That is a wow. That's like air out the room. Wow.
And let me add another twist to it in terms of politically. Bob McCulloch was just recently in the Democratic primary, and he was unopposed. And
he wasn't unopposed, Ike. Leslie Brodnax ran
the campaign. Yeah, that's right. I stand corrected. And that was a sister in the race. I mean, going into the general election, he does not have any opposition from the Republicans or what have you. However, the person that he supported for what we call St. Louis County Executive, Steve Stinger, and they ran a number of racist ads against the current black office holder, St. Louis County person named Charlie Dooley. We have to really look at this general election. We cannot punish Bob McCulloch by getting him out of the office unless we have a tremendous writing candidate, and we would have to.
Let's write in Gerald Christmas.
You say what now?
Let's write in Gerald Christmas and support it.
I know that's right. I'm throwing that out there. Gerald, you hear that? That's a great challenge.
All right, she put me on Front Street, but I got a pretty good practice going right now. Two kids getting ready to go to college. I fell on the floor twice before, but I'm more than willing to financially and physically support somebody that wants to get out there.
But you know what, Gerald? I mean, this is just for open conversation. Because I did research the St. Louis County Executive. If we want to flip the punishment on Stinger, you got three candidates in the November election. You got a person from the Constitutional Party, Joe Pasadena or something like that. And then you got the Libertarian candidate, Theo Brown. So those are some, and you got the Republican candidate, Rick Stream. So, you know, in my humble opinion, we got to take a real affirmative stand to punish Bob McCulloch, racist indifference to our community. We need to knock out his partner, Steve Stinger. That's just for consideration, that I'm going to be bringing it to the table for our coalition as far as a political initiative.
We're going to go to the phone line, y'all. We're going to pick up area code 678-887. Good evening. You're on Center Stage.
Oh, how you doing? This is Gage calling in. I was calling because I actually released a song called I Am Mike Brown, and I was told that you guys opened with it tonight.
We did open with that song. Thank you very much for calling in. We like
your
song.
Oh, no problem.
Very much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, we do. We like it, and we understand some people are calling it the protest anthem.
Yes, it is. It definitely is. I just wanted to express the actual people. I've been listening to you guys' show tonight. I hear everybody talking from the political standpoint, and I just wanted to speak from a standpoint of someone who's actually in the environment that Mike Brown was living in and just going through his everyday struggle with dealing with police harassment and things of that nature.
Where do you live at, brother?
I'm in Atlanta right now. I'm from Philadelphia, so I know it from that standpoint. I've lived in California, so I've been around. But right now I'm in Atlanta, Georgia.
What are they saying about this situation in Atlanta?
I mean, it's just crazy. Like, we actually had a camera crew. We were going around to the rallies. We marched for Mike Brown, and, like, we were actually going up to police officers asking their opinion with the camera. Like, they wouldn't talk on it. They wouldn't speak on it. And it's like, I mean, everyone is outraged because that could have been their child. Like, this young child was taken from his mother for no apparent reason, just, you know, just out of the power behind that badge and the overuse of it that we deal with in this community. It's outrageous here. Like, so I know how it is, and I know how it has to be in Ferguson because, you know, they raised up here for the cause. Like, so I can imagine.
Well, we're thinking about doing a major youth rally up here to get the youth involved. You know, could you get large groups from Atlanta, from like the AU Center, to come up and be a part of that?
I mean, of course, if that's something you guys are putting together, I'm 100% behind it. Like, I 100% feel this cause. I didn't want to do the song for publicity or anything like that. I just want to be fully behind anything that will just at least help in the aid to, you know, stopping some of this police harassment and violence. So anything I can do to help, you guys have my full support.
All right. Well,
yeah, that definitely is great help.
Hey, Chaz, this is Mark. I want to thank you for calling into the show and for putting together, producing that song, and for your willingness to answer the call from our guest tonight to go to Ferguson and support their efforts. I really commend you for what you're trying to do to contribute to the cause.
Thank you so much.
Chaz, first of all, I'd like to ask you, what motivated you to write that song? Because, you know, there's a lot of people out there who can write but have not addressed it yet. And, you know, I think there's only 3 songs that I've heard so far that have addressed, you know, the issue of Mike Brown's murder. What moved you to write on it?
I mean, my whole situation was the anger. I was checking the news out. I saw it on the news. And it just I saw it so much because I deal with these same things every day. I'm harassed by police. You know, I'm thrown on the wall. I'm random searched just for going down the street to the store. I'm harassed. I've been a gun pulled on me by a police officer before. So it was really just anger, and it was piling up. I was like, I should do the song, maybe not. But then I saw his mother on the news, and when I heard her talk, I just started crying. Like, I broke down, and it was just like, I have to speak on it because I'm not a political person. I'm not in the political spotlight. So it's like, I have to do what I know how to do. And the only way I knew how to do it was through the song. And I actually didn't know it would take off how it took off. I was just going to really express my views and get my anger out. And it just took off like wildfire.
Well, brother, let me just say this. I listened to it at the beginning. It was great. And that was a political statement. So understand you did both a political and cultural statement with that. And that's what we have to get more, brother. It's just like going all the way back into the early 60s with James Brown on Black and I'm Proud. You know, there were artists like even Teddy Pendergrass who said, wake up, everybody. It's about, and you know, part of the movement is a cultural component. And we need brothers like yourself to be challenging all these other hip hop artists, instead of the filth that they be projecting. What you have done needs to be projected much more on a higher scale. But again,
it definitely has to, because it's no substance in the music anymore. I was just telling a friend that, like, it's no different mood music. Like, everything is one mood. Everybody wants to party or go to the club. But I'm like, if I lose a friend or something happens, like Mike Brown, I can't listen to that music. It doesn't, you know, mellow me out. It doesn't give me a message. And these people, what these rappers don't understand is these kids really look up to them. So when they're glorifying the drug sales and glorifying the women in the club, it's like, okay, that's what the kid wants to do now, as opposed to, you know, someone really helping, telling these kids, hey, you can be whatever you want. Not only that, you can be great. Like, you don't have to be stuck in the same neighborhood where you might be gunned down with police. You can move out, move to these suburban areas without doing illegal stuff. I'm 31 years old, have yet to have been locked up, and I grew up in the most urban, dangerous neighborhood. It's just all about having the mind control to stay focused and do what you need to do, and that's what we have to do. We have to bring content and substance back to music, or it'll just die out.
And, you know, you are exactly on point when you say we have to bring the content back, because what I thought was interesting is that my office is in the same building as the hip-hop station here in St. Louis. And the reason why I knew that the shooting had occurred, I was in my office doing some work, and I turned the radio on, and the hip-hop station had totally changed their format right after the shooting. They started playing all of this old conscious rap. At one point, they even put on some Maze. And I was like, what is going on? And that's when they started talking about the shooting. So they even realized that they were trying to calm everybody down. And they even realized that they had to change their format to get people to calm down. But by morning, they were right back to that foolishness. And I don't know if Edward is still on the phone, but, you know, I'd like him to comment on the music and the part that it's playing in all of this.
Yeah, I'm sure. And I feel like the music definitely does play a big role, especially in my generation, because we had a lot of rappers. I don't want to pinpoint any one rapper, but it's a lot of people that's onto this drill music, and that's what it's called. It's called drill music, and it's basically hardcore rap, and it targets black young men, and especially my generation. And I say my generation, I like to get that out there, that my generation is affected by this. And all aspects of this situation, when it comes to the music, the education, like the situation with Mike Brown, like everything plays a role in this whole situation. If it's not economics, it's political. If it's not race, it's gender, and it's all in my generation. So the music does play a big role, because that's what, like you said, that's what people. That's what young people my age thrive off of. They listen to the music. They're influenced. They're very easily influenced because they see it so much, and they see it so fluently when they turn on the radio and they turn on the TV. That's what they think is cool, and it's really not. So
correct.
We have more people in my generation to go out and speak and try to regain the focus of those young minds. That'll help a lot. That's why me and a couple of the people that I've organized with, we're trying to get back to the youth. I want to go to high schools. I want to go to local parks where a lot of people hang out, and I just want to ask questions and try to grasp their minds and just try to see what's in their inner thoughts. Why are they so angry? Because that's what I see a lot in my city, in the city of St. Louis. Less than 24 hours, there's been about 7 shootings.
Wow.
3 people died today alone. 3 people died today.
Six within. That's a whole nother issue that we also have to address.
It's all violence and death. Like, that's one thing that we really need to get out there. We to stop the violence, and that's my main focus. Anytime I'm on an interview, yes, go ahead.
Let me piggyback on that, Edward. You know, in the middle of the Mike Brown movement, it seemed like, you know, there was a whole wave of, well, why is it that, you know, black people aren't concerned when a black man kills another black man, but everybody's just rising up on this Mike Brown issue because a white cop killed a black man. So when you heard that didn't deter you from your focus in terms of continuing on with the movement. But what did you think when you heard that throughout, you know, the time that you all have been out there?
I mean, well, I feel like that's false information. They say people don't get outraged when it's a black-on-black crime. I do. I lost my father to a black-on-black gun crime in front of my face. I've seen it, so I've always been against gun violence, and I've always been against black-on-black violence because, like, instead of you going to white communities or any other communities, any other race, you don't see as much violence and as much anger as you do in my community. You don't see people helping each other. You may see it, but you don't hear about it. You only see the bad in the black community, and that's something that we need to get more of. We need more help and more love in my city, period. But we need to get it around the world.
Could I interject on this point? I would encourage anybody who's listening, they need to get this book called The Wretched of the Earth, written by Frantz Fanon. That in it, he does an analysis of the oppressed nation at that particular time in Algeria. You had all the symptoms that we are exhibiting today, violence among the population toward each other, thievery and what have you, all manifest because of the colonial rule at that time of France over the people in Algeria. The same thing manifests right here in this country. The colonial rule or the rule of these super rich people that denies economic opportunities for black people, that we have a failed educational system, we have the overabundance of the propaganda through the media that impacts our people, you have the drug crisis where you have drugs not being brought into our community, but from outsiders, if you were to trace where those drugs come from. In fact, many people have a historical amnesia when the CIA was caught with their pants down during what was called the Iran-Contra scandal with Reagan at the top, where they were bringing the crack into our community. Mm-hmm. All of that is compounded into our community, and so you have it. And then because our families have been, the father's missing because of the prison industrial industry, with all of those issues, we have what we have right now in terms of that being carried out in the street in terms of this misbehavior because of the social conditions that have been created by a ruling elite of people who don't give a damn about us. And their only motive is to make money, money, money. That's the bottom line. It goes back to this kind of wicked system that allows the conditions, as I just articulated, to exist. And so that's the manifestation that comes out of it.
Well, you know, I'm based here in Arkansas. You mentioned the drugs being shipped in to the United States. And at that during that period of time was whenever President Clinton was governor of Arkansas, and that's when those drugs were being shipped into the MENA airport in MENA, Arkansas. And so you have positions, people in positions of power who rise to greater power as a result of their complicity in these crimes.
Absolutely.
Against humanity. And
absolutely,
that's something that has to be pointed out. The other thing is I was listening to all of you discuss the music and the art and how that plays into it and how important it is and how it can send either a negative or a positive message and help or hurt the community. And there was a guy who, his video has received 16 million views. His name is Prince EA. EA, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, if it's Prince E, but it's spelled Prince EA. And his video is about 3 minutes long, and it's entitled What No One Wants to Say About Ferguson. And I would encourage everyone, I'd play it right now for you all if the host would let me. It's only about 3 minutes long.
Okay.
He has a
okay.
really powerful message about getting to know who you are.
I agree. Go ahead and play it. Sure.
Okay.
While he's setting that up, Mr. Baroudi, one thing I came to see watching the protest on television is that you guys who are out there on the battlefield, I called it, were under basically spiritual and psychological warfare. Did you all feel that when you were out there?
Well, you know, first of all, I mean, I was taking a – when I first received the call, I was at my business. And one of our members called me saying I needed to get to the complex. And by the way, I had actually lived in that complex back in the early 70s and formed a housing organization back in that time. And we had ran a candidate for the city council at that time. But when I was called there, I was just angered right off by the force that was shown, the militarized police, the police dogs. And then as I walked up into the complex, the wails and the anguish of the people, it just angered me to no level. I mean, I, you know, I mean, I was just outraged, the bottom line. And from that moment on, you know, as I had shared with you offline, I've been caught deep in it. It's like a whirlwind of different things that's happening. So on the spiritual warfare, yes, this is spiritual warfare. It's economic warfare. It's political warfare. It's total warfare against our people. And by the way, over the years, I've always said that we are in a state of low-intensity warfare because part of warfare, you have propaganda. We have already talked about that. You have prisoners of war, which is our brothers and sisters incarcerated throughout America. In fact, America is the largest jailer of people in the world, more so than China, that has much have a greater population than this country. And disproportionate number of the people incarcerated, of course, is black people. In fact, black males make up 6% of the total United States population, but are over 70% of those incarcerated. So those are prisoners of war, and the casualties are the young brothers who are shot dead on the street. In fact, the FBI just came out with a study of 5% of the cities across this country where there's been police shootings, and they have reported over 400 black people have been killed by the police within 1 year. And that means that within 24 hours, two black men are 48 hours, are shot and killed by police officers across this country.
Wow.
So we have war.
Those are staggering numbers. Mark, are you ready?
Chaz just sent me a message on Facebook. He lost the line, but he wanted me to I've got his contact information. Was that Mr. Baruti that was asking for his information about him coming down to Ferguson?
That was Mr. Christmas.
That was Christmas.
Oh, Mr. Christmas. So if I can get the information to Carrie and she can forward it on to you. This Prince E, he said about 16 million people have watched his video. Numbers, however, mean nothing to him. He said, I cherish the messages I've gotten from people telling me that my words put them on a path to find their true selves, the self beyond behavior patterns, beyond race, ethnicity, orientation, experiences, and memories, the true self. That makes me want to cry tears of joy. I love all of you. New videos coming on Monday, but here's his video.
All right, man, tell me what you just said, dude.
Yo, man, come on.
What did you just say?
All right, so we're talking about Ferguson.
Right, right.
Celebrities, politicians, activists, whatever. How do you fix Ferguson is the question. Right? And we fix Ferguson in this... I got to get my car, man.
All right.
Yeah. We fix Ferguson in the same way we fix Afghanistan, Gaza, Palestine, Chicago, and that is to stop. We have to stop and be open to the possibility that we have been brainwashed on every single level of our lives. Brainwashed with conditioned thoughts, thoughts that we have fought over, died over, killed over, gotten angry, sad, and depressed over.
Okay.
We're so loyal to these thoughts, right?
Right.
But we got to question them. They were created by the culture that we were born in. Look at that word, culture that we were born in, right?
Okay, all right.
This culture taught us that race was real, and we believed it. It taught us that war and violence creates peace, and we believed it. It taught us that love was weakness, and we believed it. We ate it up, right? But open any history book, right? Any history book, you'll notice a trend. Generation after fucking generation. The same story over and over again. We've tried everything, the politics, the protests, the rallies, the riots, the marches. Whatever works,
right?
These things create short-term results, not lasting solutions. And just because our parents or grandparents believed something or did something doesn't mean that we have to continue that cycle, man. Yo, this is our time right now. As I stand here right now, this is our time. Billions have come before us, and billions will come after us. We have a chance right now to make a real difference. Or we could die doing the same thing that we've been doing over and over, expecting different results.
Right.
So the question then is, what have we not done? See, everybody's worried about changing this, changing that. What's on the outside, right? But we've forgotten about that which is looking outside, which is ourselves. Who are you? Is the question. Right?
Yeah.
Who are you in the deepest sense? I'm not talking about your fucking race, your ethnicity, your heritage, your fucking ancestry. I'm not even talking about your experiences or your memories. Who are you in the deepest sense?
Okay.
Because figure that out. Because there will never be external peace if there is not first internal peace. And once you figure that out, I promise you the entire world will transform, will change. And as more and more people find themselves, mankind has the opportunity to transform into kind man. Right?
All right.
So, you know, Jesus once said that forgive them, they know not what they do. And think about that. Forgive them, they know not what they do. They know not what they do because they know not who they are.
Okay.
Sound like that. A lot of people, they won't understand the words that I'm saying. They just won't hear it. They won't hear it. Some people will respond negatively. But for the few of you guys watching this, wherever you're watching it, I urge you to try it. Try to find out who you are inside of your body or what you are inside of your body. What do you got to lose? That's it.
I appreciate it, man. All
right, bro.
There you go.
I hear him, but I think I disagree with the fact when he said protesting isn't working. Ferguson is a prime example that protesting is working. It's the way
He's one point of view. He's one point of view. I think his real message, you know, he may not be right about everything, but his one message that I believe he is right about is that somewhere along the way we've got to have internal peace. We got to know
right.
who we are.
Internal what? But I don't know.
I'm very interested in hearing what Mr. Crawford, Mr. Baruti, and Mr. Christmas, and Mr. Bond all have to say about that topic and how they might be able to enlighten us about it.
I mean, well, from my point of view, from someone younger, I feel that is true. You do have to find inner peace with yourself. You have to see what, you know, what's bothering you, and you have to fix those issues within yourself, and then you can reach out to the next person. It's a cycle that we have to go through, and it starts with the self. You have to get your mind together, get your focus together, and then basically reach out and tell someone else how to do it and show someone else the way, and that'll ease a lot of tension and basically the community, the world. That'll ease a lot of emotion. Just finding peace within yourself and just passing it on. So I agree with what he did say. I do agree with that point. But I feel the protest, like the gentleman said, the protesting is working. It is getting things done. It's getting voices heard. People are coming together. And that's just a piece of unity. That's something that I haven't seen yet. That was my first time actually being in a protest. So seeing mm-hmm. that type of unity and that type of, you know, connection from basically strangers from all over the world, that was something new to me. That was a great experience. This whole experience, yes, we did take a loss. We lost Mike Brown. And that is tragic. But what's coming behind this is something that I want to see unfold, and I do want to be a part of it. It's very compelling to see.
And to your point, and to Carrie's point, Carl Jung, a famous psychologist, once said that enlightenment is not imagining figures of light, but making the darkness conscious. And I think that's what people like Mr. Baruti and Mr. Christmas and the others are doing there on the ground in Ferguson is they're pushing forward and making the darkness conscious.
And when you say the darkness conscious, that meaning like the darkness behind the police force?
Behind everything, behind the fact that there's white supremacy, behind the fact that there's racism, and a lot of people misunderstand racism because they'll talk about white racism versus black racism. There's no such thing as black racism if you understand truly what racism is. Yes,
right.
black hatred, there's black bigotry, there's black, you know, discrimination, but racism has to do with the fact that when this country was founded and the slave trade was implemented, there was a race between countries to get here and to exploit the resources, and so all they did was tap on the ISM, and we had what's called racism in America.
Let me drop when we're talking about coming to consciousness.
Yes.
I'm 66 years old, as I had mentioned. My first level of really becoming conscious, and that's one of the problems, internal problems of our community, because if you knew yourself, then we don't know our history to the degree that we should know as a people. And then if you knew that, then more and more people would be involved, masses of our people would be out there to transform the conditions. But I'll never forget my first kind of like rally I had went to a speaker named Stokely Carmichael. I'll never forget this, who I end up having a positive relationship with. He was speaking to a crowd, and he used how black people at that time had been miseducated and in a foolish state by using the example. Because when I grew up, we had a staple of the movies, Tarzan movies, you know, and I was into Tarzan. But he was just pointing out, here, a little white person in the jungle, whooping all our people, controlling the animals, and we rooting for him. I said, damn, you're right. I've been tricked like a mug. I say that because, like Malcolm said, our people over the years have been bamboozled and tricked into hating themselves and loving our enemies, or having them up on a high pedestal and not respecting ourselves. And that all goes right back to what I had said earlier, propaganda.
Yeah.
And that's even reflected in the educational materials that do not provide the true worldwide contribution of black folks.
That's
and
right.
So it's all of those lean to what and the state that we're in today.
We all need a re-education, Mr. Baruti.
Absolutely.
White people especially, but black people too need to be re-educated on their own history. We need to be educated on your history. That's
absolutely
something we were cheated out of in this nation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Let me close out with this question. For those people who are not on the front line, and Gerald, Christmas, and myself have spoken to the fact, we know there are people that can't be on the front line for many reasons. But for anybody to say that you can't do something would be a falsehood. So I would like for those people who have been on the front line, Mr. Baruti and for Edward, to speak to someone who maybe thinks to themselves that they shouldn't get involved. Please tell them, based on your experience from being down there, why they should get involved with the movement.
I would say, first of all, Mike Brown could be, and that's why I'm involved. I have grandchildren. I have children. And if I'm not out here on the front line to change these conditions, then my grandchildren could be a Mike Brown or a Trayvon Martin or Abdul Diallo. Some other names that's out here. That's first and foremost. Then secondly, it's just as the Bible teaches, we are supposed to be our brothers and sisters' keepers. So, just on a spiritual level, and many people profess to believe in Jesus. If Jesus was walking today, I'm sure he would be down in the midst of a protest against that injustice. So that's how I would counter that. And then last but not least, if you're too scared to get out involved, then at least, as Gerald had said earlier, send in the financial contribution. And if I may...
What
let me just put I represent an organization that's been out on the front a long time. It's called the Universal African People's Organization. People can go to our website, www.uapo.com. Or they can send, because we're part of the larger coalition, they can send a contribution to us or join our organization. And that's another thing. People need to join an organization that speaks truth to power and have a track record of being involved with the upliftment of people. So, you know, that's what I would say.
Edward, why should someone get involved with the movement?
I feel like everybody should get involved with the movement because one voice won't get heard. The more voices we have, the more faces we have, the more we can push our movement further. We can spread the word further. You know, it takes more than just one person to make a change, and we all know that. So the more people we have, you know, it's always better. It's always better to get different opinions and, you know, to meet different people. You never know who you're standing next to. So you get out there, you all for the right cause, you're all doing the same thing, you're all for one cause. You know, you may meet somebody that can push your voice further. They may not want their voice hurt. You know, they may not want their face out there. They may want to support someone who is for the cause, you know. So you may meet someone that's trying to get the message out there further, but they just don't want to do it. Just like you have some people that's in the house that don't want to come out, come out. You know, it's a reason. It's a reason that everybody is put in this situation. It's a reason that this is, you know, happening. They say, oh, everything happens for a reason. So there's a reason behind this. And I feel like Mike Brown would die in vain if we weren't here doing something to stop the reason he died. And that's
what
to
is
get justice.
What is the best way for people to follow you or get in touch with you?
If it's like someone wants to contact me via email, or you can follow my social site. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm on Twitter and Facebook, but Twitter is the main way that I communicate with a lot of people.
What is your Twitter address?
My Twitter address is IYEPANTIE. No, I'm sorry. It's IYE. I'm spelling it out because, you know, I don't want to say it, but I'm spelling it out. It's IYE.
Go ahead and say it. I don't care.
Okay, it's I Flood Panties.
Okay.
But it's the I in your face. It's I Flood Panties. The I in your face, Flood Panties. That's my Twitter handle.
And that's at Twitter, and that's the best way for people to follow you. What about Mr. Christmas? Is there a website? Or because people need to know where to get legal advice and that sort of thing.
We want final comments before we give out information. Mr. Christmas, this is caller on you. Can you give us final comments?
My final comments would be to get engaged in this movement. I encourage everybody from around the nation and around the world to get involved in this movement, and let's all come together to make a change in our community, meaning the African-American community. Let's change what's happening with police brutality issues. Let's change what's happening in our economic situation, our educational situation, and let's definitely move to make a change in what's going on with this music. I think that's number one, because I think if we can change the music, we can really change the whole culture.
Right, great. Mr. Baroudi, final comment.
Well, I just have to echo Gerald. Now, first of all, again, I just want to emphasize that to make change, people have to be involved. It has to be a mass movement. So people need to have a badge of honor by joining an organization. Secondly, people need to make a commitment to all those who fought for the right to vote. At every election, people need to vote. Then thirdly, we need to pool our dollars together for helping ourselves economically, and we have to choose different targets to punish on the economic level the system for the brutalities that they visit upon us as a people. And finally, people need to embrace a spirituality that to personify the godness in them. Then they have to understand that you are your brothers and sisters' keepers, and you must do the right thing by speaking truth to power.
Mm-hmm. Edward Crawford, final comment.
My final comment is basically, yes, to echo what everyone is saying, get out there, get involved, tell someone to tell someone. If you can't do it, tell somebody else to go out there and do it. Get involved. Get, you know, be a part of it. It's all to get one thing done, and it's to, well, it's to get many things done, but just we want unity, we want peace, and we want justice.
Mm.
That's all I want. That's what we want here.
Mark Daniel, final comment.
My hope is that the listeners tonight are as inspired as I am by the guests that were on the show tonight. I think that they each have something tremendous to offer their community, and the courage that's exemplified by people like Edward, and the steadfastness, courage, and tenacity of people like Mr. Christmas and Mr. Baruti is an inspiration to people like me that's on the sidelines and watching what's happening there in Ferguson. So I just want to tell you how honored I am to be on the show with you tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Christopher Bond, final comment.
I equally want to commend all of you gentlemen for your sacrifice, for your commitment, and for your greater outreach of compassion to humanity. And then I would just say unity, unity, unity. We have to cut down the barriers because there is power in numbers, and we are a brother's keeper, and we actually want to not just believe but do the credo or the biblical connotation, do unto those as you would have them do unto you.
Okay.
Amen.
Listen, we're going to give out contact information. Attorney Zero Christmas, how do they reach out to you? If they're looking for an attorney in your area, in the St. Louis area, how do they reach out to you?
They can find me on Facebook at Christmas Law. They can also, you can also email me at ChristmasLaw@yahoo.com. You can always email me there. You can also call me at 314-652-2200. Remember, don't say nothing and don't sign up.
I love that. Tell them how they can find you or reach out to you.
Okay, they can get me on Facebook under Zaki Baruti. They can go to the website www.uapo.com, and the UAPO is for Universal African Peace Organization. Or they can call me at area code 314-454-9005. Or they can email me at zakibaruti@hotmail.com. That's zakibaruti@hotmail.com.
Okay. Edward Crawford, again, try that Twitter account one more time. They can find you on Twitter under what?
Twitter is I Flood Panty, the I in your face Flood Panty.
All right, so y'all heard it here first. Listen, that's going to have to be the final comment. We'd like to say again, thank you to our guest.
Ask him what does that I Flood Panties mean? What does that mean, Robert?
Yeah,
okay,
I
want
to know that too.
The I Flood Panties is, I'm a ladies' man. I'm a handsome fella. So, you know, I arouse the ladies, you know. I'm a ladies' man. Follow me on Twitter, everybody.
Okay. We won't judge you. We'll be in prayer.
I'll start meanwhile. And that'll be the final word. Thank you to my guest, Mr. Zaki Baruti, Chad Scott stopped by, Edward Crawford, Darian Seal, and Attorney Gerald Christmas. I also would like to thank you, the audience, for listening. A reminder, the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage, the host, or our advertisers. Also, listen, y'all, we do this each and every Friday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Central, 9 to 11 Eastern. That's what we do right here at Center Stage. We bring topics just like the one we did tonight. Also, a reminder, send us a message via email, centerstageradio@yahoo.com. Tell us what you think of the show, or if you have a show idea you'd like us to check out. Again, send us a message at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. Okay, guys, we got to get out of here. We've gone over a little bit. But again, thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.